The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We come to the question of, you know, whether executive privilege applies or whether they can assert it. I mean, to me, what really should happen is if the executive branch at the White House says this is privilege, then they need to make an argument and to say, you know, this is why this is privilege. This is why your need in an impeachment inquiry doesn't outweigh it. And they should be allowed to make that assertion, an argument. But you know, I would like to see that. I think it would be a very hard argument to make, and I think the Senate should and would ultimately sort of overrule it.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 14th, 2020. The impeachment articles are heading over to the Senate. There's going to be a House vote tomorrow. There's going to be a little parade where the managers who will be appointed take it over, and then we're going to have a trial. It's going to be a Senate trial, and we gathered around the Jungle Studio conference table to imagine what that trial will look like. In the Jungle Studio with me are Margaret Taylor, Molly Reynolds, and David Priest, and joining us from the wilds of Tennessee by the magic of telephonic communications is Jonathan Schaub, Lawfare contributor, who is going to be teaching next year at the University of Kentucky. We're going to be talking about the ceremonial aspects of the impeachment trial that will kick it all off. We're going to be talking about witnesses. Who can they force to show up? And can they force them to answer questions? And we're going to be talking about the president's defense. How would you defend Donald Trump against these charges? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 495, Imagining an Impeachment Trial. I want to start, Molly, with a just kind of where are we now? As we are sitting down to record, it appears as though the House is getting ready to send over the articles. What do we know about where things stand now and when what is going to happen?
Sure. So we're recording this on Tuesday, and on Wednesday afternoon is when the House is expected to take a vote that will both name managers, so name the members of the House who will make the House's case in favor of impeachment in the Senate, and formally authorize the sending of the articles and associated papers across the Capitol to the Senate. That, like I said, that vote is expected to happen tomorrow on Wednesday. And then all of the reporting suggests that the trial itself will really get underway next week, probably on Tuesday, after the Congress recesses from the Martin Luther King Day holiday. Between now and then, I expect we'll learn more about exactly what the Senate plans to put in its initial organizing resolution, what procedural details the Senate expects to fill in for how a trial will work around questions of will there be a motion to dismiss? When will that motion be in order? Will there be a motion to call additional witnesses or introduce additional evidence? When would that happen? That sort of thing.
So if memory serves from the Clinton impeachment trial, there is this weird ceremony that happens before the thing gets started.
And I actually, memory does serve on this because I have recently reread the rules. But it's actually quite scripted. So, David, like, the House is going to pass this thing, appoint their managers, and then notify the Senate that they've appointed managers, and then just like walk us through what happens.
Well, it is scripted. That's the only part that's really well scripted. But that doesn't mean that it's not potentially without drama, because you can have somebody rise up and object even in the swearing in of the senators for the impeachment. It happened back in 1868 with Andrew Johnson because there was a supposed conflict of interest. Benjamin Wade was the Senate president pro tem, and in the absence of a vice president, he would be the one who would take the presidency if Andrew Johnson were actually removed. So in a sense, he was voting to put himself in the presidency as a senator. And sure enough, when he rose to take the oath being administered by Salmon Chase, presiding over the Senate, Democrats objected. And 3-hour debate ensued over whether, in fact, you could have a senator being impartial in this way. Of course, the Democrats objected to Wade, but then the Republicans turned right around and objected to David Patterson, senator from Tennessee, who happened to be the president's son-in-law. And sure enough, they decided they would go ahead, take the oath, and indeed both of them did vote there. But I have heard some talk about a move to disqualify McConnell because of his statements about he's not being impartial, he's coordinating with the White House. I would not be surprised if you have a Democratic senator make a motion to disqualify him when he takes the oath. And then, of course, it gets to the vote, which will not remove McConnell from the trial.
Okay, so but David, you've given us all the things that could complicate the script. Mm-hmm. But what is the script? Like, what happens, assuming nobody does any Benjamin Wade's or Salmon Chase? And I just want to say having a chief justice named Salmon is awesome. Much more interesting than having a chief justice named John.
but he could bring salmon to the trial and eat it.
What does the script look like?
Yeah, the first day is just pro forma. It's just that ceremony. And then they almost immediately adjourn. And that's actually when it gets interesting, because that's when behind the scenes you will have the senators trying to figure out probably things like witnesses and documents and how this will happen. In the Clinton impeachment trial, that's certainly what happened. Is immediately after that pro forma session, you had all kinds of negotiation going on. The trial does not begin immediately. As I recall, it then picks up again the next day. And that's when the opening statements begin by the House managers.
So I was actually watching.
This is Margaret Taylor.
I was actually watching some of the 1998 proceedings just to kind of get a sense for it, see what it was like. And the president pro tem of the Senate at the time was Strom Thurmond. It was very interesting. So he administered the oath to the Chief Justice, which I thought was kind of an interesting dynamic there.
That must have been very weird for Mr. Rehnquist.
It was all a little bit, it was just fascinating to watch. And then it was Chief Justice Rehnquist who then, you know, administered the various oaths, including to the senators. So it was just kind of an interesting dynamic to see between, you know, the Article 3 branch of government and the Article 1 branch of government relating to, you know, the president, Article 2. Just sort of a fascinating, as you said, quite formal and lots of ceremony sort of around it. I actually will be watching this part with interest, just if only to get a sense for the personal dynamics, how the senators are, you know, reacting to this type of thing. I've heard from interlocutors on the Hill that there will be no, you know, Blackberries or iPhones allowed, that the senators won't be allowed to use their devices. So it will be, I think, I will have that sense of ceremony and quietness about it, I think.
And the Senate rules, I believe, do have the rule that senators must remain quiet. That is, unless they are raising a point for the Chief Justice and perhaps for a vote, they are to sit there silently and listen, which raises a huge—
On pain of imprisonment,
yeah.
I think, is the
And that raises a huge issue for how many opening statements they're going to have to sit through. You know, back with Johnson, there were 7 House managers who all wanted to give very, very long speeches. Senators were falling asleep in their seats. With Bill Clinton, they decided that wasn't good enough. Let's have 13 House managers, all of whom need to have a chance to speak. It'll be interesting to see what Nancy Pelosi does here in terms of just the sheer number of House managers fighting for airtime.
So there's both the question of how many House managers there will be. As David points out, there were 13 in 1999. We're still waiting for Speaker Pelosi to release a list of who those might be. It's widely believed that both Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler will be among them, but who else is included? The question of how long both sides, both the House managers and the president's counsel, have for their opening presentations is one of the things that's yet to be settled. In the Clinton trial, both sides were given up to 24 hours to make their initial cases, though they did not use all of that time and generally used that 24 hours. If they had used all of it, probably would have been about 3 days of full session on both for both sides of the case. They ultimately only used, in the case of the House managers, they used about 5 hours on the first day, about 2.5 hours on the second day, kind of similar for the president's team, that sort of thing. And so the question of how long that actually takes is a good one. And it's one of the things that we will see resolved, I think, over the next couple of days.
All right. So let's jump ahead to we get through this ceremonial opening, which, as David describes, may or may not be punctuated by one or another form of shenanigan. We then go through some number of hours of both sides presenting their cases. And then we hit the first, I think, clear road bump in the trial, which is a motion to dismiss, which McConnell has suggested that he will propose that somebody will propose or they will entertain at this point. And the question at that point becomes, are there 51 votes to carry a motion to dismiss?
So before we get to a possible motion to dismiss, we can talk about that. There is, I think, at the end, after those initial presentations by both sides, likely to be a period of questioning from senators. Again, this is what happened in the Clinton case. The initial organizing resolution provided for up to 16 hours of questions from senators. Again, they didn't use quite all of that time. And that's another place where we could see some interesting things happen. As David pointed out before, senators are not supposed to speak during this process. They submit questions in writing to the chief to be asked. Exactly how the questioning might unfold, I think, is also a little bit interesting to think about. In 1999, it ran through the parties. So, and this isn't provided for in the rules. It's just how the Senate chose to approach this task. And so they alternated a question from the Democrats, a question from the Republicans. And then it was sort of up to the leaders of each party to decide, you know, which questions were asked. There was, at least on the Democratic side, they sort of had a list of senators who were willing to have their names attached to questions, even if they weren't physically there to ask them. So that part, I think, also will be interesting. And that's another place where we could see some objections raised, some potential involvement from the Chief Justice before we get to this question that you've raised, Ben, about a possible motion to dismiss.
All right. So good catch on me on that. Yes, the senators asking questions of the House managers as well as the president's lawyers goes in this intervening period. Then we have this motion to dismiss. Is it clear at this stage, and this question is open to any of you, is it clear whether McConnell has the votes to carry a motion to dismiss? There have been some news stories recently suggesting that some of the Republicans want to hear from some witnesses. So are we confident at this stage that a motion to dismiss does not carry? Are we confident that it does, or do we just not know? What do you think, Margaret?
So I think there's been actually a little bit of confusion out there in the press on this question, because in some press reports, it's framed as, do senators favor a motion to dismiss sort of right out of the box, even before presentations are made or before questions are done? And I don't think that is seriously being contemplated. What I think is being contemplated is this motion to dismiss, is, again, as Molly said, sort of after the initial presentations and after questions from the senators. My sense is that I think we don't totally know, but there were some press reports about a number of Republican senators, including Lamar Alexander, Senator Murkowski, Senator Collins, Senator Romney, basically expressing skepticism about their support for the motion to dismiss. So I personally don't have utter confidence at this particular moment about what that vote looks like.
Yeah, I've seen that reporting today, too, that Lamar Alexander has said, yes, we want to call witnesses and see documents, which implies that he would vote against a motion to dismiss. If that is true, and it's along with Senators Collins, Murkowski, and Romney, that's the magic number, because that's 4 plus the 47 Democrats gets you to 51.
Right. There's also this question of, and to Margaret's point about there being a little bit of fuzziness around kind of exactly what we're talking about here. There's this question about, do some number of Republicans actually have witnesses from whom they want to hear, or do they simply want the opportunity to have a vote on whether to hear from witnesses? So I could see it going either way once we get to that point, that, you know, there may well be 4 Republicans who say up front in the initial organizing resolution, it is important to me that resolution provides for a vote on whether to have witnesses. I'm not making any promises that I will vote to actually call witnesses or introduce additional evidence, but it is important to have the vote.
And I just want to make one statement about why this could potentially be quite an important question, actually. In the 1999 Clinton organizing resolution, it specifies that the opening sort of arguments made by the House managers and the president's defense team shall be limited to argument from the record. So at that stage, if this resolution looks similar, which I expect it will, the arguments will be limited to sort of what's already in the record from the House. It's only after that part of the process concluded, there's this question about presentation of evidence not in the record. And there is some reporting out there that there is additional evidence floating out there, particularly about communications between OMB and the Pentagon about the president's hold on the $400 million for Ukraine, that could potentially actually be quite relevant. So this isn't just sort of a question about politics or the politics of a vote. There actually is actual evidence floating around out there that could potentially be relevant to the facts of the record and the guilt or innocence
right.
on the
I think
impeachment.
This point Margaret is making is one in a series of important observations about key differences between the current situation and the Clinton impeachment trial, that we can draw a lot of comparisons, and the Clinton case is helpful in a lot of ways. But there are also situations, and this point about the potential introduction of new evidence because new facts simply continue to emerge about what happened, that was just less of an issue in the Clinton case because of the facts on the ground.
Right. It also, of course, raises the question of what counts as the record.
Sure.
Right. If you're in the Clinton case, the record was the record established by the Starr investigation, and everybody knew what the record included. Here, it's all the House testimony, but is it also everything that's appeared in the New York Times subsequently? All right. So now let's assume we have survived a motion to dismiss, and now the House managers want to call their first witness. And let's just, for purposes of imagination, call him John Bolton. And so presumably we now face a challenge, some kind of challenge, individual level challenge to the witness. So we thought about who's the person who we wanted to bring in who could walk us through all of the questions you would need to answer before you actually got John Bolton to answer questions. And we thought the person we need to hear from is Jonathan Schaub. And so, Jonathan, welcome to the Lawfare podcast.
Thank you.
Were you joining us from Tennessee?
I am, yes.
So tell us, we have now survived a motion to dismiss, and Adam Schiff, with his itchy trigger finger, has said, I want Bolton and his mustache up there on the stand, like right now. What has to happen for Schiff in order for Schiff to actually get to question John Bolton and his mustache?
Well, so I think there are a couple of things, a couple of possibilities. But I would say first, you know, at the what I think is really important at the motion to dismiss stage is that the senators are thinking about, you know, the motion to dismiss, as we talked about, it's on the record. And so if someone is going to vote to dismiss, they should be voting to dismiss sort of on that record. And if they're saying we need more evidence or we're not sure about these allegations or the factual evidence, let's call a witness. And there's a majority of the Senate to do that. And then they call John Bolton. And Bolton and his mustache have agreed to appear, at least from press reports, which is a different approach than he took in the House. So he would show up, but he hasn't said anything, at least in the reporting that I've seen, about how he would regard or respond to a direction from the White House that says, you know, these things that you're going to be asked about, conversations with the president, diplomatic negotiations, these are sensitive areas that the executive branch has sort of long considered to be components of executive privilege. That privilege belongs to the president. So we're going to instruct you, don't talk about any of that. And that's the course that the executive branch normally takes when witnesses testify. Think about like Sally Yates, when she was going to testify, she got a letter that said, don't talk about national security and presidential communications. They don't really have any mechanism for enforcing that. So a lot of it depends on Bolton's reaction. If he says, I understand that these areas are normally privileged, but, you know, I think he said in his statement, considering my obligations, I think I need to answer these questions. He's free to answer them. And the only way the executive branch could really stop it would be to go to court and to seek an injunction, which is, I think, a remote possibility and one that is sort of contrary to what they've been saying all along in the McGahn litigation and other litigation, that the court should stay out of these kind of privilege disputes.
Okay, but so if he decides to testify and answer the questions, we assume he's going to show up because he said he's going to show up. The White House then sends him a letter that says, don't answer any questions that involve communications with the president. He decides to stiff that request, as some other people have.
Right.
Nothing stops him from stiffing that request. And I certainly agree with you that the likelihood, the optics of a district court intervening to prevent testimony at the Senate sitting as a court of impeachment presided over by the Chief Justice seems pretty remote.
Yeah.
But what happens if Bolton decides to honor that request? So he'll show up pursuant to his letter, and he'll answer questions about, you know, what color the wallpaper was and, you know, maybe his communications with OMB and with, you know, with Fiona Hill and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. But he's not going to answer questions about his communications with the president, which are the only thing that anybody wants to hear from him about anyway. What happens then, either as a matter, in your judgment, under the Senate rules, to the extent you have a view of that, or, I mean, could the Senate go to, you know, sort of file a motion to compel in the district court? Like, what happens if Bolton refuses to answer questions?
So I think it's really important, and I've got working on a piece about this, but it's important to kind of identify exactly what he is saying. So if he is saying simply, you know, they've directed me to do this, I'm going to follow that direction, but there's been no formal assertion of privilege. And, you know, traditionally when a president asserts executive privilege formally, what happens is the president makes a determination. It's supported by an opinion from the attorney general, from OLC. And as part of that, they balance the interests of the executive branch against Congress. But largely, as I've written about on Lawfare a few times, that the executive branch kind of avoids that step by just saying, well, we need to take this action to protect the privilege, sort of this prophylactic layer that prevents the president from having to make that hard determination. So if Bolton just gets up there and says, I'm going to follow the direction, and there's been no assertion of privilege, that's the hardest thing for the Senate to get past. I mean, if he gets up there and the president says, I've asserted privilege over this, 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 and this, and I'm not an expert on the Senate rules by any means, but the way I understand it, the Senate could simply vote to overrule that assertion of privilege. And once overruled, then it's no longer valid. Maybe Bolton and the White House would take another view, but if there's a bipartisan Senate majority that is saying we overrule this determination of executive privilege, and it's a Senate sitting in the trial, I think it's their role to judge the privilege. But if Bolton says, I'm not going to answer just based on the president's direction, the Senate, you can't overrule an assertion of privilege because there has been none. And so at that point, I think what would have to happen is the Senate would have to vote to say, answer it, or we're going to hold you in contempt. And the tradition, the practice of the executive branch has been, if an individual is faced with a contempt charge, that there has to be an assertion of privilege as a defense to the contempt charge. So that would be the way the Senate could force the president to actually assert privilege and then have a vote on it, at least in my view.
Can I just clarify that there isn't really a precedent in the context of impeachment proceedings, right? You're talking more about the precedents in the context of sort of the normal interactions between executive and legislative on sort of investigative and informational matters, right?
Yeah, I don't know of any precedent about privilege and impeachment, except for sort of Nixon's kind of half-hearted attempt at the end, which was unsuccessful.
So what about the merits of this? I mean, I look at this as an outsider and I say, if you'd ask me, what does the core of executive privilege represent? I would have said, something like the national security advisor talking to the president individually, a direct communication between them in which he's advising the president about how to interact with a foreign government. You might say that's kind of the molten core of executive privilege. If it stands for anything, it stands for the idea that you can shield that from Congress. On the other hand, I do have this sense that executive privilege should never be used, can never be used to hide wrongdoing. And of course, it's not an absolute privilege in any case. It's subject to a balancing test, at least in a balancing test in the law enforcement context, and presumably some sort of balancing with respect to the Senate. So on the merits, if John Bolton shows up and the president asserts executive privilege, should a senator respect that? A, and say, number one, the president is entitled to assert executive privilege here, or should the senator say the president is entitled to instruct him not to testify, but I'm also entitled to make an adverse inference there about what he would say, and furthermore, I'm entitled to take this as evidence of the substantive allegation of obstruction of Congress in Article 2 of the impeachment articles? Or three, should the senator say, no, I'm not, you're actually not entitled to assert executive privilege over this material, or rather the Senate institutionally shouldn't respect the assertion and seek to force Bolton to answer the question? What's the right answer?
Well, I'm glad to take a stab at it.
You're the world's foremost authority on the subject. So what you're going to say right now is actually the authoritative answer. It's the closest thing we're going to have to an authoritative answer to the question. And every senator is going to listen to this podcast. No pressure.
No pressure, right? I actually think the answer is relatively simple. And it's one that is pretty well established. So as you discussed, I do think sort of the core of the crown jewels, as I've heard people say, of executive privilege are the president's, internal conversations, deliberations, particularly with someone like the national security advisor. I mean, you're touching on a number of different areas that are highly confidential within the executive branch. But at the same time, executive privilege is a qualified one. And the Watergate case with Nixon is instructive, I think, because what the court said there was, a claim of undifferentiated privilege or need for confidentiality in conversations can be overcome when there's a specific need, and in that case, it was a grand jury, for information in consideration of a crime. And the executive branch, anytime there's an assertion, always undertakes this balancing and saying, yes, there's an interest in presidential communications or in national security information, but we have to balance that against Congress's interest. And if you go back and look at statements of presidents and even from OLC in the past, there's a long history of them saying that, you know, when Congress is doing legislative oversight or looking into, you know, executive branch departments, it has a need for information, but it often doesn't have a need for sort of precise factual information about what happened in the past. It just needs enough information to legislate or kind of to know what's going on, to know what it needs to fix. But impeachment is different. And impeachment, it's a trial, as a grand sort of a grand jury proceeding with the House and then the Senate. It's a trial, and there is a need to know the facts and specific facts. So I think if there are facts that are out there that a senator thinks are material to deciding whether the president should be convicted of a high crime and misdemeanor, that there is no question that that need would overcome any undifferentiated interest based on, you know, the general confidentiality need for presidential communications and national security. And I think Nixon says that. I think history says that pretty clearly. You know, if there are other conversations that are not necessarily material or that have classified information, I mean, the Senate can go into closed session and protect those, or there could be an assertion of privilege. Maybe the balance is different if the information is not directly relevant. But to the extent you're talking about conversations that are directly relevant to the charge, and that there are the majority of the senators that says we need this information, I think history is pretty clear that the qualified executive privilege is not going to keep them from getting that information. So I think the Senate should then vote to say we need the information, and I don't imagine a court would sit and even hear that case, and if they did, I can't imagine they would ever overrule that determination.
One other thought on where the balance would fall on this is that there is one thing that is otherwise unrestricted in the presidential's toolkit, and that's the pardon. And so there's a bit of a parallel here, which is the pardon is the one thing that the Constitution says, except in cases of impeachment. So there already is, in a sense, a constitutional analog to say something that otherwise would be true, privilege, is not true in a case of impeachment, because pardons explicitly are not allowed in cases of impeachment when they are allowed for absolutely anything else.
And I do think we come to the question of, you know, whether executive privilege applies or whether they can assert it. I mean, to me, what really should happen is if the executive branch, if the White House says this is privilege, then they need to make an argument and to say, you know, this is why this is privilege. This is why your need in an impeachment inquiry doesn't outweigh it. And they should be allowed to make that assertion, an argument. But, you know, I would like to see that. I think it would be a very hard argument to make. And I think the Senate should ultimately sort of overrule it.
All right. So now we have gotten past a motion to dismiss, and we've gotten John Bolton and his mustache up on the stand, and we've gotten him to answer questions. So if I am the House managers at this stage, and I've gotten this far, I presume I don't stop with Bolton, because there's Mick Mulvaney, and there's Blair, and there's, you know, Rudy Giuliani. There's a bunch of other witnesses. And so, Molly, since we don't know whether there's the votes to shut the whole thing down with no witnesses, we don't actually know what the full appetite for witnesses look like. Schumer, in his original letter, asked for 4. At the end of the day, if you get Bolton and nobody else, that's kind of a depends what Bolton says, but what do you think the House managers, whoever they end up being, is their goal to get as many of the key witnesses forward as possible? Is their goal to get One, as a kind of symbolic expansion of the record, is their goal to get a couple discrete people? What are they actually trying to accomplish here?
It's a good question. It's a little bit hard to answer because in part it gets into this tension between the two chambers and sort of what are the interests, even within the same party, of Democrats in the House versus Democrats in the Senate, and the fact that to get witnesses in the Senate that Democrats would favor, they do need to get some number of Republicans to agree to them. It's, you know, important to remember that, you know, as long as the trial goes on in the Senate, senators have to be there 6 days a week and physically present in the chamber for some number of hours, which is a heavier lift for some senators than others, including, you know, the ones who are running for president. So there, I don't
just to foot stomp that point. I mean, this is the 3 weeks before the Iowa caucus. And if you're Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, you have a powerful incentive to side with Mitch McConnell on keeping this thing short.
You do have an argument. I think at the same time, the forces of party in the Senate will, it would shock me if one of those senators voted with the Republicans on something. But there is this question of, you know, how much time is the Senate going to take on this? Another relevant consideration is something we've heard and seen reported regarding, for example, Senator Rand Paul, who has said that, you know, even if some of his Republican colleagues want to go along with these Democratic requests for testimony from Bolton or others, that he says that, you know, that doesn't mean that they're not going to also have to vote on calling some of the witnesses from whom Trump wants to hear. So Hunter Biden, for example. And so there's this balancing act, I think, on both sides of the aisle about the difficulty of various votes for different kinds of senators, how much time the trial will take, and frankly, just the amount of uncertainty that we go into this with. So senators, Leader McConnell, chief among them, do not like uncertain floor situations. And so the notion that we might get to a place where we're having sort of free-flowing debate on the Senate floor about, or off the Senate floor, about which witnesses we're going to hear from is really just not the kind of thing that we are used to in the contemporary Senate.
It's like a no-deal Brexit.
I mean, I would remind folks how unusual the circumstances in the summer of 2017 when they tried to repeal the ACA were, that, you know, we went into that debate with literally no idea what was going to come out the other end. And that was a shocking kind of experience in the contemporary Senate. And so I think the degree to which senators are uncomfortable with that level of uncertainty and are quite comfortable with delegating a lot of power to their party leaders to make these kinds of decisions is a real dynamic that we're going to see play out here.
And I just want to add that it may depend, the answer to your question, Ben, may depend on what kind of defense do the president's lawyers put forth in their arguments. Because if their arguments revolve around questions of fact, which they did in the House, frankly, about what the president's direct role was in holding back the money for Ukraine, the assistance money, then it's going to seem extremely odd for the president's attorneys to be raising that as a defense, to have at least three, maybe four witnesses who Chuck Schumer has identified as being able to answer those questions out there and then not call them. It's very odd. If, on the other hand, the president's attorneys offer some sort of a different type of defense, so for example, something like, you know what, even if all these facts are true that the House managers are putting forth, it doesn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense, so none of this stuff matters, that puts you in a different situation vis-a-vis fact witnesses.
Right. So let's talk about the president's defense, because I think this is one of the big wild cards here. And let's start with what I think may or may not be a strategic objective of the president's lawyers, whoever they end up being, which is to make this hurt for the Democrats. So if you want to make it hurt for the Democrats, you want to be able to call Hunter Biden, you want to be able to call the whistleblower, right? All of the stuff that people were talking about in the House, you want to actually get to do. But as I read the rules, in order to do that, you have to have a defense to which those things are actually relevant, right? Because if you argue, well, okay, even assuming all these facts are true, it doesn't rise to the level of an impeachable or removable offense, or the president was within his authority to do these things, then Hunter Biden's behavior in Ukraine is not relevant. On the other hand, if you're arguing the president was behaving reasonably because he was genuinely concerned about terrible Biden corruption, and here's what he had heard, and here's what the truth is, well, then I think you can make an argument that Hunter Biden's testimony and perhaps Joe Biden's testimony is in fact relevant. And so, Jonathan, jump in if you have thoughts on it. But if you're advising the president now, what's the defense that you actually want to put forward to maximize whatever strategic gain you're trying to make here? Or is the goal simply to try to make it go away as quickly as possible?
Well, I mean, I kind of agree that if the president's defense gets up and says, you know, which there have been some statements in the House and elsewhere that, you know, they didn't prove that the president directed Giuliani's actions, or they haven't shown enough evidence. At that point, you're really playing into the hands of the Democrats and the senators who are willing to call witnesses. And if your goal is to get rid of it quickly, I think the argument has to be, in which I think we've seen some suggestion of as well, like, this was a perfect call. Everything was perfect. This is all normal and nothing is wrong with it, and to get rid of it. And that to me seems like the approach they will take. But there does seem to be some perverse incentives to maybe prolong it and to call witnesses like Hunter Biden to keep the Democratic presidential candidates in Washington, and also to, you know, inflict pain, as you said.
Yeah. And just to – I mean, it seems like Mitch McConnell wants this to go quickly and go away quickly. The president earlier on was sort of – you know, there's a lot of bluster and stuff about, oh, I want this like really big trial to, you know, really show how innocent I am. It seems like, at least at this moment, the president is a little more on board with the McConnell approach of sort of getting it done and over with pretty soon. So, yeah, my guess is there won't be this thirst on the part of the president for lots of witnesses.
What do you think, David? Is somebody going to make the case that they're going to go medieval and actually try to like take the fight to Biden? Because
yeah.
if you won't make the case, I will.
Yeah. If the main argument that McConnell in talking to the senators has in mind is the president has the authority to do this no matter what, and it seems like he's got the votes for that, there's no need to really do anything else. So I guess it depends on how much Trump leans on McConnell, if Trump really wants to bring the pain. And I don't see McConnell – I see McConnell saying to Trump, look, we've got you here. He's already said he's coordinating with the White House. He's already said he's not impartial. He said, we've got the votes. We're fine here, Mr. President. We don't want to do that. And there is a valid reason for that. Yes, maybe you bring the pain to the Democrats by finding a way to get Hunter Biden on the stand. On the other hand – as the trial goes on, you open up the opportunity for wild cards. You open up the opportunity for more reporting to come out, for John Bolton maybe to say, yes, I will tell everything, or even for the speeches to become more impactful. Even in the Clinton impeachment, you had some Democratic senators listening to the Republican House manager speeches, and on a few of them, they said, oh, wait a minute, that actually makes sense. This is making me think twice. Now, we all know which way the vote went. But it opens up that opportunity for wild cards. And I don't think a good strategist is going to want to do that if they think they have the votes early on.
Okay. Now I'm going to tell you what's actually going to happen, because you guys are all living in too theoretical a world. You all have correctly described the arrangement that has been made, which is McConnell said, we got your back. We're going to keep this short. We're not gonna do anything. But the president is going to watch Adam Schiff give his opening statement. He's going to get progressively more and more agitated, and he's going to start tweeting things. And he's going to tweet, why aren't you calling crooked Hillary? Why aren't you calling Lion Jim Comey. Why aren't we talking about the witch hunt and the insurance policy? And that's going to go on for days and days and days. And remember, his lawyers in this process don't report to Mitch McConnell. They represent him. And so there will come a point in which his lawyers, in apparent retaliation for the witnesses that the other side called, in compliance with his tweeted orders, will have to start trying to call some of these witnesses. And these poor Republican senators who are not allowed to say anything, who've been sitting here being browbeaten by the president's tweets, will all vote to back them. That is what's actually going to happen. And so Hunter Biden is totally testifying in this proceeding.
So I think we may know earlier than that particular moment, because I'm watching closely who is the president choosing for his team. And he's going to have to decide soon, because this is starting soon. And so there's pretty solid reporting that Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, will lead the team, and that Trump's personal lawyer, Jay Sekulow, will also join the team. Beyond that, there's kind of a question mark. There's been some reporting that Rudy Giuliani is pressing Trump to join the defense team, which is interesting because he's like a primary actor in the first article of impeachment. But, you know, Giuliani went on Fox News and basically said the Supreme Court could dismiss the case against Trump. And Giuliani said, I would say if it's unconstitutional, it's null and void. And then Trump tweeted that clip saying, thank you, Rudy. So, you know, we're going to know something if he puts Rudy Giuliani on the defense team. There's also been some press reporting that there's some contemplation of Jim Jordan or Mark Meadows or John Ratcliffe, who are Republicans in the House who defended, you know, the president with vigor during the impeachment proceedings in the House, whether they'll be on the team. Probably not, but it's been floating around. And then finally, you know, Alan Dershowitz, that's also been floating around. And that also will tell us something about what the president has in mind for his defense if Alan Dershowitz ends up on the team.
Okay, so here is a legal ethics question for anybody who knows the answer to it or who thinks there's an answer to it. I would assume that for Pat Cipollone to lead the team is a bit of a confusion of his role, because I'm not convinced that the institutional presidency has a deep-seated interest in the question of whether the incumbent of the office committed an impeachable offense or not. And so my question is, isn't that the leading of an impeachment team the kind of thing that you would normally have your personal lawyer do? And what is the White House counsel doing in that role, unless the nature of the argument is going to be this is a category of offense that per se cannot be impeachable? Am I missing something there?
Briefly, you know, there's an opinion actually from OLC, the sort of issue near the end of the Obama administration that touches on this a little bit in the context of a deposition and a private counsel and whether the department executive branch could pay for the private counsel. And so I think there's some role for the White House institutionally here, including like the privileges that we've discussed, and there may be some other institutional arguments, but it's got to be really carefully defined, as that opinion lays out, that the someone representing the White House cannot represent the personal interests of the president. So there needs to be a sort of strict demarcation between what interests that the White House counsel would be representing and then who would be representing the president's personal interests, which I think, as you say, like the impeachment aspect is a personal interest, not one of the presidency.
And there is one bit of precedent on here. It's old, and who knows if any senators even care. But back in Andrew Johnson's impeachment, the United States Attorney General decided that he could not represent the president in the impeachment trial as Attorney General. He resigned so that he could defend the president. Interestingly enough, after Johnson was acquitted, Johnson tried to reappoint him to Attorney General, and the Senate, which did not have the votes to remove Johnson did have the votes to keep him from becoming attorney general again.
The difference between the two-thirds requirement for removal and the 51% requirement for confirmation. Okay, so while we're nerding out on privilege questions, there is another one that affects not Bolton, who has said he would show up, but certainly Mulvaney or Blair or Michael Duffy or other people who the president who did not show up at the House, which is whether they would show up at all. And that would have been an unimaginable question, at least to me, until this past year. It is no longer an unimaginable question. So, Jonathan, can the Senate actually, you know, quite apart from whether they can get people to open their mouths when they're on the stand, can they get people other than John Bolton to sit in the chair at all?
I think it will largely depend on the individual. I mean, Duffy is a separate category. He's an OMB official. And the reason he didn't show up in the House was because the House was going to conduct a deposition and not allow counsel from the executive branch to be there. So assuming they allowed that counsel in the public impeachment trial, which I think they would, he wouldn't have a grounds to not show up anymore. But Mulvaney and Blair both relied on this testimonial immunity of presidential advisors not to show up, the same claim that Bolton made in the House and that former counsel Don McGahn is now litigating. So they, if the White House claimed that for them and they were willing to abide by it, which would be their choice, and you know they have a direction from their boss, the president, to do so, then the Senate, I think, would have to vote to overrule that immunity. The problem is, unlike privilege, it's not a qualified immunity in the executive branch's view. So I'm not sure how the White House or how those officials would react to that. I mean, assuming that there would be a bipartisan Senate vote for them to appear, and Bolton's going to go, you think, to me, I would think they would show up, but you know they may not. And if the White House directs them not to, they may feel bound by that direction not to show up. And at that point, either the Senate would have to go to the courts, or you know, maybe they just turn to the second article of impeachment, as the House did, for obstruction.
And do you think it is plausible that the Senate will be like, we'll subpoena you, and if you don't show up, members are free to simply consider that evidence in support of the obstruction of Congress count? Or does the obstruction of does the record in the obstruction of Congress count freeze on the date on which the House passed it?
I mean, I think they would be free to consider it negatively. I mean, it's the doctrine has been sort of longstanding within the Department of Justice and OLC opinions, but it's never been applied to impeachment before. And it's pretty far-fetched to say that an impeachment witness could just decline to show up at all and not claim any privilege, and there's no balancing and the Senate has no recourse. So I think they would be free to consider that negatively in their consideration of the charges.
I do just want to point out one additional thing, which is a feature of the impeachment rules, which is that it does empower the sergeant at arms to go out and get people. So, and I fully understand that in our like current politics, this isn't a thing that people generally favor. And I do think that the Senate would probably go to the courts rather than doing that. But it is there. And back in the day, you know, when they were getting ready for the Johnson trial and they had other impeachments going, this was a real thing. Like the sergeant at arms and his deputies, they would go out and actually like sort of get people. So it is a thing.
And I would say, the idea of the surgeon of arms, and this happens in oversight context as well, you know, sort of going having an armed standoff at the White House or whatever it may be, I think would lead the courts to maybe act more quickly than they otherwise normally would if this did get to the courts. I mean, I think this could get resolved very quickly by the courts if it did go there, and they would be willing to move faster than they have been willing in other contexts.
All right, we need to wrap up. I'm going to pose the elephant in the room question to each of you in sequence, starting with David. Given that we all know how this is going to end, that is, with some variation within a reasonable margin of error, we're going to have a party line vote to acquit the president. Maybe a few Republicans join Democrats. Maybe Doug Jones joins Republicans. I mean, who knows? But you're going to have something like all the Democrats vote to convict him, all the Republicans vote to acquit him. Why does this matter?
For two reasons. One, the impeachment itself is a rebuke. It was intended as such by the founders. And if you have an impeachment, contrary to what Nancy Pelosi has done for the last few weeks, if you have an impeachment, you have to have a trial. So the trial is the completion of that process. It also matters because whether it's the opening statements, whether it is testimony from witnesses, whether it is some wonderful summation from a House manager, you actually may present the case against the president's actions more clearly than even Adam Schiff did in the House when moving towards impeachment. So I think it matters for that reason. Related thought, it may matter because no president, even with the exception of Andrew Johnson, is so mercurial and so instinctively self-destructive. And you may have an opportunity for the president himself to do something in the trial. It may not change the vote, but it may actually get him in further in another direction. And I'm looking to a date 2 weeks out from the start of the trial. I'm looking at Tuesday, February 4th, because that is when President Trump is scheduled to go to Capitol Hill and deliver the State of the Union address. Back in Clinton's day, when he delivered the State of the Union address during his impeachment trial, you had two of the House managers not show up. You even had John Boehner not show up. Now, in that case, he was celebrating his 25th wedding anniversary with his wife in Hawaii. Good call on his part to keep that tan going. But you could have a State of the Union address where the president, unlike his predecessors, decides this is his chance to tee off in person on the people who are putting him into this ridiculous trial. Then the fireworks begin.
Molly, why does it matter?
So for me, it matters because once Congress, beginning in the House, decided to go down this route, they, as an institution, have a responsibility to fulfill about how to conduct themselves as a co-equal branch of government. And so, you know, I am in agreement with former President Ford that an impeachable offense is whatever the House of Representatives decides it is. But once you've decided that you're going to undertake an impeachment inquiry and then an impeachment trial, I think as an institution, as a co-equal branch of government, you have a responsibility to do so in a serious and responsible way. And so how this all unfolds, I think, is really important in that context. And then the other thing that I will say is that, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about whether the fact that we've had this impeachment means that future presidential impeachments are more likely. I don't know what the answer to that question is, but if it is yes, and we are going to see more presidential impeachments in the future, what precedents get established, both sort of politically and in the actual sense of Senate precedent, what happens in this case will have or will potentially have bearing on what happens in the future.
Margaret, sound and fury signifying nothing? And if not, what does it signify?
So I agree with Molly about the institutional issues and concerns, and I share them. My real sort of question mark about the meaning of this whole thing is, does it provide a moment of catharsis for the country at all? In watching some of the Clinton sort of proceedings in the end, I was struck by how after he was acquitted, Bill Clinton went out into the Rose Garden and essentially apologized to the country for what he had done.
It was one of his most graceful moments as president.
Yeah, and what he apologized and for what he had put the country through. And it was just this, it just struck me as kind of a moment of catharsis. There was also some moments during the Senate trial where, in particular, like Dale Bumpers, who was a longtime senator, was making a presentation in defense of Bill Clinton. And he kind of had all the senators laughing at some joke he made or something. And it just felt like there was this sort of moment of collegiality and catharsis. So I do wonder, question mark, is there going to be any kind of moment like that for the country? What's different here, obviously, is Trump. Can't imagine Trump at all going out into the Rose Garden and doing something like that. And in fact, it will probably be double down and fight some more. So I guess for me, it's a little bit like I'm looking for that, but I'm not sure it's going to come. And I think that's actually highly sort of problematic going forward, that there won't be a moment of catharsis.
Jonathan, you get the last word. Is this process important? And if so, why?
So I'd say two things. You know, I agree with all that's been said, and going back to how you started the program, talking about the ceremony and the official solemnity that is going to be happening. And so I think seeing that and seeing if the senators and the country as a whole can sort of rise above the partisan, you know, sniping and obscuring facts to sort of approach this in a solemn manner will be vital and to sort of show us something about the country. And then coming at it from the kind of privilege perspective, I mean, this impeachment is very different in that the White House really obstructed a lot of the House's inquiry, if not all of it. And this is an inquiry that was done by the House. There's not a Starr report. And so if impeachment becomes more common, you know, that kind of stonewalling, these privilege claims and immunity, that's all based on, you know, what's happened in the past and historical precedent. So to the extent the Senate as an institution and the House as well want to protect the impeachment authority and the authority to get information, I think there's a lot of important precedents that will be set here about how the Senate treats the administration's claims of privilege and immunity and whether they're sort of going to side with that, which is really a diminution of the institution's authority, or whether they're going to say, you know, you've got to turn over some information.
I will just add one additional importance of this proceeding, which is it will keep us in podcast material for as long as it goes on. And for that, we all owe the Senate and the House thanks and gratitude. Thank you all for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Hey, some of you still haven't tweeted about the Lawfare Podcast. Some of you haven't rated the Lawfare Podcast or reviewed the Lawfare Podcast on whatever podcast distribution system you get us from. Look, we don't advertise. We don't buy space on Facebook or any of that jazz. We just have you to spread the word. So you guys got to do it. There is Lawfare swag available at thelawfarestore.com, and you know you want to wear it. You know you want to write with it, and you know that you want to hold your lanyard for your government job, your cards on the Lawfare lanyard. So go on to the Lawfare store and buy the swag. Our music is, as always, performed by Sophia Yan. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineer this episode is the one, the only Jacob Schultz. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.